One of the greatest names in the entire Tanaic literature was Elisha ben Avuya. He had been a leader in the Klal Yisrael. He had been a tremendous, tremendous sage. And while that's the way he began his life early on, that's not quite the way he ended up. And the Gemara in Chagiga tells us that four nichnasu bepardes. There were four people who went lefnai v'lefnim. It was Yom Kippur. It was Shabbos. They prepared themselves and they were allowed to go and see as much of HaKadosh Baruch Hu as a human being could. These four people were Ben Azai, Ben Zoma, Rabbi Akiva, and Elisha ben Avuya. And whilst they prepared themselves, and whilst they were on the madrega, on the level to be allowed to do this, it didn't end up as well as one would have thought. Gemara tells us, Ben Azai hitzitzu meitz, Ben Azai died, Ben Zoma became insane, Elisha ben Avuya became an apikoros, and only Rabbi Akiva alone came down b'shalom. And to understand this Gemara, we have to understand what the Marsha explains to us, and he says as follows. We human beings take a very cavalier attitude towards speaking to Hashem. Listen, Hashem, of course Hashem listens to my tefillahs. Of course Hashem is my friend. And the Marsha explains to us that we don't have a clue to the glory of Hashem Shechina. If you could imagine thousands and thousands of malachim, powerful, powerful beings, each one more powerful than the other, each one more glorious, and each one so filled with strength that it's beyond human comprehension. But there are thousands upon thousands upon thousands of groups, each one containing tens of thousands, maybe millions of malachim. One are fire, the other ash, that each ash, the other are powerful lightning. If a human being were ever to experience a malach, if a human being were ever to experience seeing a spiritual being fully revealed, he would tremble and fall to the floor in absolute trepidation. And throughout Tanakh, when it happens, that's exactly the reaction. And these groups and groups and groups surround HaKadosh Baruch Hu and sing Shira, sing praise, and in the center of it all is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's glory, if it could be, right there. And when these human beings went up and saw as much as a human being could, explains the Marsha, Ben Azai said, I want no part of the physical world. He saw such purity, such holiness. He said, I don't want to come back. He died. Ben Zoma short-circuited. It was just too much. It was an overload. Elisha ben Avuya somehow made a mistake. He saw something that led him to apikoresis, to become a heretic. Only Rabbi Akiva went as far as the human mind could. He stopped and he came back b'shalom. But in any case, when Elisha ben Avuya came down, he was a full-fledged apikoros. He was a heretic. It was Shabbos. It was Yom Kippur. He got on a horse and began riding. And the Gemara in Yerushalmi tells us that a bas kol, a heavenly voice, came out from the kodesh kodeshim, from the Beis HaMikdash, and declared, Shuvu vanim shovavim, return, my children, return. Chutz, with the exception of Elisha ben Avuya. And he understood that to mean that he will not be accepted back in tshuva. For a person on his madrega, for a person on his level, for a person to have known Hashem that clearly, and then to rebel, he assumed the Basco was telling him he would not be accepted back. At which point he said, no, listen, I have no world to come. I might as well enjoy this world. And it was Yotza Latar Bezra. He went to a bad path. Gemara tells us that very day, he walks over to a zona, to a prostitute, and he propositions her. And she says the words, what? Aren't you Elisha ben Avuya, the famous Tana? It was still Shabbos. He reaches down into the ground, pulls out a radish, and she said the words, Acherhu, must be somebody else. I must be mistaken. From that moment on, his name was no longer Elisha ben Avuya. The name Acher, someone else, became accepted. And that was his name from that point on. Needless to say, his Talmidim, all of his hundreds, thousands of Talmidim, separated from him, except for one. Rabbi Meir felt that he could still learn from Elisha ben Avuya. He could take out the tochen and remove the chaff, and he remained a loyal Talmud. and remained with his Rebbe. In fact, the Gemara tells us that one day, much later, it was also a Shabbos, the two of them were traveling. Acher was up on a horse, Rebbe Meir was walking. And at a certain point from up on top of the horse, Acher says back down to Rebbe Meir, "Meir, chazor b'cha, Meir, stop. Ad kan shiarti b'kvei susi, I measured with the steps of my horse. Ad kan trum Shabbos, this is where the trum Shabbos is. You can't go any further." And Rebbe Meir, looking up to the horse, looking up to his Rebbe on top of the horse, says, "Vata chazor b'cha, why don't you return?" A play on words. At which point, Acher says to him, "I already told you, I heard the boss call Shuvu vanim shovavim. Everyone is walking back in Shuvu except for me." And he continued in this way, continued in Tarbas Ram. Midrash Rabbah tells us that on his deathbed, Acher is just about to leave this earth, and someone comes to Rebbe Meir, Rebbe, your Rebbe is dying. So Rebbe Meir runs quickly to Acher, sees that he's about to leave this earth, and he says to Acher, now do tshuva? Acher says, what, is it possible to do tshuva even now? Would Hashem accept me? Rebbe Meir quotes a pasuk. At that point, Acher begins crying, v'somach Rebbe Meir. Rebbe Meir was happy, he was joyful. Rebbe Meir assumed that those tears were tears of tshuva, and at that point, Elisha Mervuya died. However, they were not tears of tshuva, and his tshuva was not real, and he wasn't accepted. The Gemara tells us that there was a tremendous tumult up in Shemayim. L'adayna l'dina v'lola asi l'alma. He will not be accepted into Gehenim. He will not be accepted into Gan Eden. He's not accepted into Gehenim mishum da'asak b'Torah. He was a tremendous Torah scholar, Torah personality, a man of that stature. It is a bazillion for the Torah for him to go into Gehenim. On the other hand, he can't go into Gan Eden because mishum d'chato, whatever he accomplished on the good, he did keneged that, he did opposite that on the bad. And for eternity, this man was to remain in limbo, not in Gan Eden, not in Gehenim, just there. Rebbe Meir was privy to this. Rebbe Meir was able to understand what the din was, and he knew where Acher was holding. And he began being Mavakesh Racham, and he began asking mercy. He began asking mercy, and he understood it was to no avail. Finally, Rebbe Meir said the words, "When will I die? And I will cause a pillar of smoke to come up from the kever of my Rebbe as a sign that he's accepted into Gehenim." The Gemara tells us that, in fact, the day that Rebbe Meir died, a pillar of smoke began rising from the grave of Acher, and it remained there day after day after day, week after week. That pillar of smoke was a permanent fixture. Many years later, Rabbi Yochanan said the words, "What did Rebbe Meir accomplish? Very nice, he took him into Gehenim, but he's still there. The idea of Gehenim is to clean him up, to allow him to go to Gan Eden. He's still in Gehenim." Says Rabbi Yochanan, "Masai Amos, when will I die? And I'll stop the pillar of smoke." The Gemara tells us that the day that Rabbi Yochanan died, the pillar of smoke stopped. And at the Levaya, at the eulogy of Rabbi Yochanan, they said the words, "Mi ki Rabbi Yochanan, who's like Rabbi Yochanan? Even the Shomer, basic Gehenim, even the guardsmen of Gehenim can't stop him from doing what he wanted." It's understood that Rabbi Yochanan took him out of Gehenim, and he was then in Gan Eden. And this Gemara is very interesting and provides for us a number of lessons. And let's start with the first question. The first question is that we understand that Gehenim is a place to clean up. We understand that it's a chesed. We understand that it's a special benefit that Hashem does for a person. But it sounds very difficult to imagine davening for mercy. Hashem, please have mercy. Please let him into Gehenim. Please let him burn. And if we don't understand that question, let me spend just a minute illustrating what Gehenim is. Imagine you reach into the oven and you reach for the challah, but by mistake you don't reach the challah, but you touch the bar that it's resting. Ah, you burn your finger. You burn your finger and for hours, throbbing pain. That's one finger, one digit, one little part of one finger. We had a counselor in camp. It was a Madura bonfire, and he was walking by the bonfire. He tripped, and he landed palm first into the hot coals. A softball-sized blister, his whole hand. You can't imagine the screaming. Still, a hand, one part of the body. Imagine you're in the shower, and the water's too hot. You have soap in your eyes, and you reach for the cold water, and by mistake, you turn on hot. Ah! At least now we're dealing with the body. But it's still very, very poor illustration. There's a book, Who by Fire, written about a very frum woman who was living in Yerushalayim. She was in her apartment, and somehow the apartment burst into flame. She runs out. And when she's safe in the hallway, she recognizes that her children are still in the apartment. She runs and grabs one kid, runs and grabs a second, grabs a third. In the end, she saved all of her children, but she suffered burns on 85% of her body. And the book Who by Fire is a very apt description of a woman's powerful emunah and bitachon, but also what it means to be burnt alive. But still, even if you imagine that, even if you imagine being in a fire, that's nothing. If you'd like to understand what Gehenna is like, do the following. Take a matchbox car, you know, a little children's car. Turn it over, and you'll see the words 1/60th scale model. What that means is if you take this 2-inch long little toy car and magnify it 60 times, you get a full-size SUV. Because if you take this little 2-inch car and magnify it by 60, what happens is you have a 5,000-pound huge vehicle. Take the hottest fire in this world. Take a kiln, 4,000 degrees, and imagine that you're in there. Multiply it by 60, because Chazal tells us the Esha Gehenim is 60 times hotter than any fire in this world. Gehenim is not meted out in months. It's not measured in weeks, not measured in days. It's measured in seconds, because the pain is so powerful. So here's the question. The Kochvei Ohr does the math for us. If you measure the time from the death of Rabbi Yochanan, from the death of Rabbi Meir, until the death of Rabbi Yochanan, you have approximately 130 years. That means this man, Acher, spent 130 years being burnt alive. How could Rabbi Meir daven, ask, beg mercy, Hashem, please let him into Gehenna? He didn't know how long he'd be there, and in fact, he was there for 130 years. How do you call that rachamim? How do you call that mercy? How does a Talmud do that for his Rebbe? And I think to answer this, we need a little bit better understanding as to life, why Hashem created us, and what this world really is about. And to do that, let me share with you an interesting observation. Alan Dershowitz wrote a book called The Vanishing American Jew. A lot of interesting things in that book, a lot of things worth reading, and there's some things that are not worth reading. One part of that book that's well worth not reading is the fact that he writes there that he was teaching a course in Harvard Law School, and the course was called Thinking About Thinking, dealing with the major life issues, big deal questions in life. And at some point during the course, he describes that they decided to rate the world's religions. Which religions got it right, which got it wrong. So they took all of the religions, Judaism, Buddhism, Catholicism, and they were rating them. Did they contribute to mankind? Did they hurt? Did they help? And they were going to give them ratings A, B, C, and D. At a certain point during the course, he says that someone raised his hand and said, Professor, if we're rating the world's religions, and religion is a way of studying God, a way of relating to God, shouldn't we rate God? So he describes it. He agreed, and they decided to do just that. Let's rate God. How did God do at this thing called creation? A, B, C, or D? Now, before I spoil the fun and let you know how God did at this thing called creation, let's focus on the world from his perspective. On the one hand, there are a lot of beautiful things in this world. There are sunrises, there are flowers, there's poetry, there's love, a lot of beautiful things. On the other side, there are some rough spots. There's pain, there's poverty, there's illness, disease, there are orphans. There's a balance, a lot of good, a lot of bad. And so on balance, he writes that God rated a B minus. not an F, didn't fail, certainly not an A+, right in the middle, on balance, God did an okay job at creating this world, a B-. Okay. Now, if I had my chance to rate our learned professor, I would give him a grade. Wouldn't be an A, not a B, not a C. I would give him a D for dumb, and I'll explain to you why. If I were to take a pen out of my pocket, I would take this pen and hold it in front of you and say, you know, this is a lousy toothpick. I mean, come on, whoever designed this toothpick did a terrible job. Look, the clicker, who needs that? And the barrel thing in there, who needs it? But worse than that, every time I get it back in my molars, I get this blue inky thing, you know. Whoever designed this toothpick did a lousy job. That would be an example of fallacious thinking, of false thinking. Because before you rate the manufacturer, you have to know what they intended it to be used as. As a toothpick, it might be lousy. As a writing implement, it might be well-crafted. And before you rate Bic, you have to know what they intended that craft to be used for. And I say, before you rate God, you had better have a good fundamental understanding as to why Hashem created us, why Hashem made the world, what we're doing here. And if you decide to rate God before you have a clear understanding as to why Hashem put us here, you're going to come up with some pretty silly ideas. And let me share with you a mashal. The mashal that defines exactly this point. Why did Hashem create us? What are we doing here? What's life about? Imagine the following. Imagine that you're invited to a very exclusive health club. Now, you've never been there before, but you know the basic layout. On the left side is the spa. On the right side is the gym. The gym has all the exercise equipment that you need to work out, the Nautilus, elliptical, everything you need to get in shape. The left side is the spa that has the steam room, the sauna, everything you need to just sort of relax. Now, you decide that it's been a very stressful week, and you're heading in right to the spa. But by mistake, when you walk in, instead of turning left, you turn right, and you find yourself in this room. Hey, what are all these red-faced people doing in here? Grunting and sweating, all this equipment. I mean, whoever designed this spa did a terrible job. That's a mashal to creation. The Mesillas Yesharim explains to us that when Hashem created the world, Hashem created two worlds. There's this world and the world to come, each with its plan, each with its purpose. This world is the gym. We were put into this world to grow, to accomplish, to change the essence of I. I'm put into many, many situations, many, many circumstances that allow me to change. When I'm done my job here, I go to the world to come, and that's where I enjoy. For eternity, forever, I get to enjoy my accomplishments. I get to enjoy what I made myself into. But two worlds, each with its plan, each with its purpose. When you understand this, life itself fundamentally makes sense. And if you don't understand this, very little under the sun makes sense. But not that it doesn't make sense to you, it doesn't make sense at all. You see, if you believe that life ends in the grave, imagine that I, like Elsie the cow, die. When Elsie the cow dies, her nefesh just evaporates. Imagine that when you and I die, it's over, blackness done. And I'd like to share with you that Hashem did a terrible job. And God wouldn't rate a B-, God would rate an F for putting so many features into this world that benefit man not at all. You ever have a headache? What about a migraine? What about arthritis? One Yom Kippur, I walked a man up 3 steps. I think he suffered more pain in those 3 steps than I suffered my whole year. Here's the question. If Hashem is goodly, kindly, and mercy, why create pain? Why create a very complex pain delivery system? And don't tell me it's to teach you to move your hand away from the pot, because avoidance pain is processed in the spine. You see, when you step on that nail, you have to pull it away very quickly. That pain is processed in the spine. The neural pathway brings the message up to the spine, and it quickly sends the message down, move, because if it waited to get all the way up to the brain, the nail would go right through your foot. The type of pain we're discussing here is a type of pain that doesn't let you get out of bed in the morning, that doesn't allow you to enjoy anything. That pain is processed in the brain, and that pain does man no good whatsoever. And it's very sophisticated. When you smash your shin, it hurts. And when you have a stomach ache, it hurts. When you have a root canal, it hurts. And when you have a kidney stone, it hurts. But the hurt is very different. Different flavors, different nuances. You could probably write poetry about the different shades of pain. And here's the question. If Hashem is kindly, merciful, and good, why would Hashem create pain? And it's not just pain. It's many, many situations, many, many obstacles that we will find in life. And when you understand that many, many situations were created for one purpose only, to challenge me, to demand of me a decision, there's no waiting on the sidelines. You decide. You either ascend, you go above this, or you shrivel up, but decide you must. And when you understand that we're here for a few short years, this is the gym, there are many, many situations that we'll put in strictly to challenge us, strictly to allow us to become what we can be. And when we've done our job here, what I am forever. Whatever accomplishments are mine for eternity. When you understand that, then life itself makes sense. But if you don't understand that, then very little under the sun makes sense. Hashem would not rate a B minus. Hashem would rate an F for doing a terrible job at creation, for putting so many features into man that serve him no good. So many situations that are clearly orchestrated by Hashem that hurt man. But once you understand that this is the gym, that we're given many, many situations to cause ourselves to choose, to allow ourselves to become the great individuals we can become, when you understand that, then life itself makes sense. But there's one more step that's critical. And this step is probably one of the most important questions that a human being can ever ask himself. Here's the question. How good is Hashem at doing that which Hashem does? Not a bad question. How good is Hashem at doing that which Hashem does? Well, if you're not quite convinced, let's look at the world. 100 billion galaxies, each containing 100 billion stars, each as powerful or more powerful than our sun. Look at a cell, a single cell in the human body that's more complex than New York City. Look at the systems. Look at the harmonious integrated systems via which Hashem created and runs this world. When you open a biology textbook, when you open a physics textbook, when you study the vastness, the awesomeness, and the symmetry of this world, you begin to get it. Hashem is very, very capable, and Hashem is very, very good at doing that which Hashem does. Okay, let's take one more step. Imagine with me for a moment the following. Imagine that Hashem were to create a world for one purpose only, and that purpose is for you to enjoy. Imagine that Hashem were to create a world strictly for your pleasure, and assuming that Hashem is quite good at doing that what he does, I'd imagine Hashem would do a very good job. And in that world, you would have pleasures upon pleasures, layers and layers, integrated superly deep, deep within pleasures with certain whiffs and different nuances. And it would last forever. That is the world to come. This world that we live in is very, very passing, very temporary. We're here one day, we're gone the next. But when I'm done my job here, my body's put in the ground and I separate. I separate and I stand in front of Hashem, and forever I am that which I shape myself into. Forever I enjoy untold amount of pleasures and bliss. As a mushal Chazal tell us, take a man, take a king who has the greatest world you've ever imagined. He has power, he has glory, he has all the wealth. Take all of the pleasure that he'll have in 1,000 years of living. It doesn't equal to one whiff of the pleasure that you and I will have in the world to come. Right now I don't see it. Right now I don't feel it. So it's very difficult. But assuming that Hashem is very, very good at doing that which Hashem does, we could assume that it's waiting and it's there. And I believe that's pshat in Rebbe Meir. You see, it's not that Rebbe Meir didn't understand what Gehenna was like. He understood quite well. But he also understood the other side of the equation. He understood that forever, if he goes to Gehenna, if this Acher spends whatever time it is that he has to spend in Gehenna, Yes, it will be torturous. Yes, it will be very difficult. But then for eternity, he'll be able to be close to the Shekhinah, close to Hashem, be able to enjoy eternal bliss. And Meir understood that it was worth it. How long is eternity? Eternity is forever, right? A long, long, long time. Forever, right? Would you like to know how long eternity is? The Chafetz Chaim gives a mashal. He says, imagine there's a huge pile of sand. And after 100 days, a bird comes and takes away one grain of sand. Another 100 days, he comes and he takes another grain. Another 100 days. So imagining that this bird were to take away 3 grains of sand a year, 30 grains every 10 years, 300 grains every 100 years, how long would it take the bird to remove the entire mountain of sand? The answer is a long, long time. That's a dimion, that's a mashal to what Gan Eden is like, what eternity is like. And what Rabbi Meir understood was, yes, it's very, very rough. Yes, it's very difficult being in Gehenna, but it's worth it. Why? Because if you understand what Gan Eden is like, you understand it's worth it, and worth it over many, many times. And there are many lessons for us to learn from this. Number one, if you find me a man who has a difficult life here, find me a man who's suffering, disease, poverty, illness, find me a man who's racked with pain, and you may say, is it worth it? 130 years in Gehenna is far more worth it. And if we understood what Gan Eden is like, it's worth it 1,000 times over to suffer that. And you and I, in our worst imaginations of what our world currently is like, we don't suffer the 130 years in Gehenna. And for us, it's an important understanding that whatever we're going through is well, well worth it. Hashem is merciful and kind and loving. Hashem has a much broader perspective. As much we think we suffer, as hard as we think it is, it's worth it, and in the end we'll recognize it and thank Hashem eternally for it. And the first lesson that we need to take from this Gemara is the greatness of the world to come, that Hashem in His infinite mercy allows us time in this world, and whilst at the moment that we're here it may feel difficult, it may feel hard, the reality it's for our best, and it's something that we'll thank Hashem forever. But I think there's an even bigger lesson for us from this Gemara. And let's focus on one point. The messenger comes to Rebbe Meir, your Rebbe is dying. What does Rebbe Meir do? He runs out, runs to the deathbed, and he says to Acher, do tshuva. Acher says, is it possible? And Rebbe Meir quotes a pasuk, yes it is, at which point Acher begins crying. V'samach Rebbe Meir. Rebbe Meir was happy, because right after he cried, Acher died, and Rebbe Meir said he did tshuva. He died in tshuva. Wow, that's great. I want to ask you a question. So what? So he cried. So he cried a little bit. The man was wicked. The man was a Rasha. So he cried and some tears fell down his cheek. Therefore what? Meaning, let's say Rebbe Meir was right. Let's say the man did tshuva. Rebbe Meir wasn't correct. That wasn't the tears of Acher at the time. But let's assume Rebbe Meir was right, and let's assume he did tshuva. So what? You mean to tell me a man can spend 10 years, 20 years doing horrible acts, and then he cries at the end, and then it's gone? And if you don't really understand this question yet, let me share with you a little bit more of what was going on. Gemara in Yerushalmi tells us that this man wasn't just wicked. He was a Rasha of unimaginable proportions. At this time, the Romans already ruled over Eretz Yisrael, and the Romans did everything in their power to get the Jewish people to violate the Torah. On Shabbos, they would create work camps. They made the Jews work. And the Romans did everything they could to get the Jews to violate Shabbos. And obviously, the Jews did everything they could to not violate Shabbos. So, for instance, if the Romans told the Jews to move something, they would specifically move it through a Carmelis, not a Rishus HaRabim, to lessen the Chilul Shabbos. If it was something that one man could carry, the Jews would allow two people, make sure that two people carry it, because again, it takes it from a Deraisa down to Rabbanan. Everything the Jews could do to lessen the Chilul Shabbos, they did. Acher would go from Roman work camp to Roman work camp. Hey, stop! No. That's a compliment. Make him walk there in Rishus HaRabim. Oh, wait a minute, that's a trick. No. Take that off of his two shoulders. No. Make one guy carry it. he would go from work camp to work camp to make sure that the Jews violated Shabbos in the most egregious manner possible. Gemara tells us that he would go into Bati Midrashim. Before it became very well known that he had turned to a wicked way, he was still Elisha ben Avuya. He would go into a Beis Medrash and say to the young Talmidim learning, what are you doing? What are you wasting your time for? You could be doing something useful. You could be a carpenter. You could be a shoemaker. What are you wasting your time here? He cleared out the Bati Midrashim. Gemara Yishalmi tells us that in the end, Biyadayim, with his hands, he choked Talmidei Chachamim. And if you'd like an illustration of who this man was, the Gemara tells us that years later, years after he died, Bito Shel Acher, the daughter of Acher, comes to Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. She comes asking for tzedakah. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was the one who distributed the monies. She comes and says, Rabbi Parnaseni, Rabbi, please feed me. I have nothing to eat. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi didn't recognize her. Biti Miat, who are you? And she said, I'm the daughter of Elisha ben Avuya. What? Says Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Is it possible? Is it shayach that anyone is left from his lineage? Says this young woman, please remember his Torah, don't remember his wickedness. At which point the Gemara tells us, miyad, immediately, yarda ish, a fire came down from Shemayim and burnt the chair that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was sitting on. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi began crying. He said, if to those who embarrass the Torah they stand up for the honor of Talmidei Chachamim such, how much more so for those who are an honor to Torah? And the Gemara ends. Now, obviously, it's an interesting illustration how even if a person turned l'ra, the Torah that he learned is his, and if he was a Talmid Chacham, even if he turned into a bad way, that Torah is his, and they stand up for his honor in Shemayim. But let's focus on a more relevant point. In walks this young woman to Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi says, Biti Miat. She says, I'm the daughter of Elisha ben Avuya. What? Is it possible that anyone's left of his lineage? Is it possible that a son or a daughter alive? Answer, Marsha, what's the big question? There are many, many Rishonim throughout the millennium who had children. Many, many wicked people who flourished, who had children and grandchildren, great-grandchildren. What's Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's question? Is it possible that someone's still alive? Explains the Marsha, Efshir, it's possible that Elisha ben Avuya was the worst human being who ever lived. You see, normally when a man does things, he's pulled by desire and taiva. He's a paro, he's a Nebuchadnezzar, he's into his glory or whatever. This man was a Tana. Yada biyumaradbi, says Hashem. He saw me. He was right there, lefnayim lefnayim. For a man on that level, a man with that clarity of understanding to turn to wickedness is so egregious. Says the Marsha, it's possible that he might have been the most wicked human being who ever lived. And now it's time for us to focus on one significant point. The Marsha also points out that Acher made a mistake. His mistake was not when he propositioned Dizona, not even when he went to the Roman work camps and tried to get the Jews to Michal Shabbos, not even when he choked Talmid Chacham Biyadayim. Explains the Marsha, the mistake that Acher made was he learned wrong pshat in the Baskol. He understood it incorrectly. See, the Marsha explains, Shuvu Vanim Shovavim means, Hashem says, take one step forward in tshuva and I'll do the rest. There's a special siyata d'shmaya. If you do a little bit, Hashem does the rest. That's a special help that Hashem gives to his nation. Says Hashem to Acher, you've lost that. You're no longer going to get special help. But says the Marsha the words, Ein dover omed bifnei tshuva. Nothing stands in front of tshuva. Explains the Marsha, he could have done tshuva. He could have turned it around. He could have regained that position. But he learned wrong pshat. He learned the words incorrectly and assumed it's over. There's no hope. And I believe there's a fundamental lesson for us. You see, when Rabbi Meir was on the deathbed of this man and he saw him crying, he assumed that he did tshuva. And you may say, come on, it's just tears. Okay, it's a moment of tshuva. Let's even say it was legitimate. Let's even say he really looked back on his life and said, what was I thinking? What was I doing? How does that change anything? And the answer is, from a physical perspective, it wouldn't change a thing. If I weigh 400 pounds and I cry and I cry and I cry, what have I done to myself? Look at me, I'm fat, I'm obese, I can't breathe, I can't walk. What have I done? And I really, really cry for 24 hours straight. I still weigh 400 pounds. The body is very, very slow to change. But I, the one who occupied the body, am not physical. I'm spiritual, I'm ruchni. And if I reach a different hakara, different understanding, then I change, I become different. You see, if in a moment of clarity I get it, if in a moment of clarity I fully understand, then I have changed. And I no longer am that person I was a moment before. And the reason why tshuva works is because the human being can change, not the body. That's very slow and very difficult to change. But the essence of I can change if I fully understand, fully get it. In but a moment, I could change my destiny. And the reason why Rebbe Meir was samach was because he assumed that on his deathbed, Acher finally got it. And he looked back on the years of what he had done and said, what was I thinking? And in that one moment, grasped the truth and changed himself. It wasn't true. But what the Marshal is teaching us is that Ein Dover Omed Bifnei Tshuva, nothing stands in front of Tshuva. And I believe that this is a fundamental concept, because I guarantee you, find me the most wicked person you know. Find me your friend who went off the Derech and did X, Y, and Z. I guarantee he doesn't reach the toenails of Acher in terms of wickedness. Killing Talmidei Chachamim Biyadayim, getting the Jewish nation to sin, but more than that, says the Mashar, it's possible that he was the worst human being who ever walked the face of the earth. Meaning to say, even he could have done tshuva. And of course, there's even more. Because he was who he was, he lost that special Siyata Deshmaya. But it takes an Acher to lose that. But you and I aren't going to be there. We're not going to reach his level of rishus. And what that means in plain language is that there's always hope, there's always change, and tshuva is actually straightforward and even simple. Now, there are levels to tshuva, and the only real difficult part is to really, really get it. But if a person reaches deep down within him and says the words, I deeply, utterly, fundamentally regret what I've done, and he cries bitter, bitter tears, and turns to Hashem and does the process of tshuva, charata, regret, kabbalah alabai, accepts on himself not to do it again, aziva zachet, he leaves it, and then he says vidui, he says to Hashem, I've sinned, I've done it. If he does a total, complete tshuva, it eradicates the sin. Now, it's unlikely that you and I will do a total, complete tshuva, because the Aruch HaTzaddikim explains to us that tshuva is a little bit like a stain on the coat. You know, imagine you get a mud stain on the coat. So what you do is you rub it. And when you rub it, some of it comes off. You rub it more, some more comes off. Rub it more, some more comes off. And if you really rub deeply into the material, finally, and you can get rid of it, except there's a little bit of a sort of a shadow left of it. And you have to really rub very deeply to get rid of everything. The Aruch HaTzaddikim explains that's how tshuva works. If you have charata, real regret, and you cry bitter tears, it removes some of the stain. The mud comes off. Still may be an imprint, still may be a shadow. You rub more, you rub more, you rub more. And if you really reach into the essence of you and really reach a total, absolute understanding that I did something that I so regret. Had I been there, I would never have done it again. I wish I hadn't been there. And I would do everything in my power not to do it again. And if you do the steps of tshuva, totally and completely, it eliminates the chait as if it didn't happen, as if it wasn't there. But any amount of tshuva lessens it, takes it away, like that mud stain on the coat, a little bit of rubbing takes off some, a little bit more, some more, a little bit, some more. But the point is that tshuva is not just possible, but Hashem has created it, makes it easy for us, and wants us to do it. But two very important caveats. Number one, if you weigh 400 pounds and have tremendous charat of what you've done, not only don't you change physically, you still weigh 400 pounds, but you also still crave food. You see, if you're an alcoholic and you crave liquor, you may wake up one day and say, what have I done? Fool, fool that I am, what have I done? And you may really reach an understanding that you have to stop and you desire to stop, but you're still going to crave the alcohol. If you do a total and complete tshuva and really stand in front of Hashem on Yom Kippur with tears in your eyes and reach a totally different perspective, you're still going to have the same longings, the same cravings, because you haven't changed the Nefesh HaBahami, the essence of you that still desires it. And so while tshuva works and it eradicates the bad things that were done, it takes them off the record. The part of you that became stronger, that became more dominant, is still there. And so you have to also work on the avera. Tshuva gets rid of the sin, but the changes that you made to you are still there. And number two, tshuva will not allow you to make up for the time that was missed. Meaning to say, if because you're involved in various hungers and appetites, lusting and etc., and it destroyed a year or a week of your life, you have to make up for that time. And you have to now head on a path of growth, of ascension, because you see, when Elisha ben Avuya died, had the tshuva been there, would have eradicated what he did bad, but those 10 years that he didn't grow, can't make up for. So the opportunity to do tshuva is a tremendous, tremendous chesed that Hashem allows us to get rid of the dirt, get rid of the damage, but we still have to do the work forward. We still have to fight the fight. We still have to get in the battle so we don't fall back into it. And we have to make up for lost time. And we have to accomplish. We have to grow. Because I don't care who you are, any avera is not just going to damage you, it's going to stop your growth. And if you'd like to understand the real damage of desire and taiva, it stops you from being close to Hashem, and stops you from growing, stops you from accomplishing, stops you from being who you could have been. And while tshuva works, and it takes off the sin, and you could eradicate it, you still have to do the difficult work, you have to battle the battles, and you have to make up for lost time, and you have to put yourself back in time after time into the fight. But this concept is key and fundamental to understand that tshuva works. Then Das Kanim explains that one of the biggest obstacles to a person's growth is the sense of, ugh, look at me, I'm a piece of dirt. Look what I did to myself. I'm filled with mud from head to toe. Look at me. I'm going to go into Beis Medrash and daven. I'm going to open a Gemara. I'm going to get a shidduch with a good from Beis Yaakov girl. If she had a clue to what I've done, what I think about, what's in my brain, she would run away. I've destroyed myself. I'd made myself black, dirty, worthless. And those words are very important words, and those words are exactly the words that the Sultan would like you to hear over and over and over. And what Chazal tell us is that there's something called tshuva. Tshuva means you take off the mud, you rub, and it gets lessened, lessened and lessened. And if you do a very good job at it, you can get rid of it totally and completely. You could eradicate it. It's not there at all. However, you have to be very careful. You see, sometimes our attempts to do tshuva can come back to haunt us. I'll explain to you what I mean. Let's assume you wake up at a certain point and you say to yourself, this is ruining my life. I want to grow. I want to accomplish. I want to be happy. I don't want to be there with hungers and lust and desire all day long being burnt by this stuff. I don't want it. And you really, really say, that's it, I'm going to change. One of the dangers is that when you go to do tshuva, you may bring back up the images, may bring back the scenes, and it may cause you to get more involved than you were before. That's one danger of tshuva. There's another danger. Most people don't understand how to do tshuva. The right way to do tshuva is to put on a white kittel. Putting on a white kittel means I know that Hashem created me. I know that Hashem gave me hungers, desires, and appetites. I know that Hashem put me in this generation, and I know that Hashem wants me to grow and accomplish. And Hashem gave me a day called Yom Kippur, gave me a process called Tshuva that works all during the year. And Hashem understands that I'm going to change, and Hashem wants me to change. And right now, I'm putting on this kittel because I know that Tshuva is going to work, and I'm a white, clean, pristine, holy Jew who's standing in front of Hashem, who has a lot of work to do. And if you're able to, in your mind's eye, put on that white kittel and see that I'm holy and pure, kadosh, I may have issues, I may have things I have to work on, but I'm a great human being with tremendous abilities who's going to work on those issues. And when I'm done, they'll be removed. Then tshuva works. The problem is that most people walk into the tshuva process as, I'm a lousy, nothing, worthless, and the guilt kills them. And for that reason, many times it's advisable not to do tshuva now. Many times it's advisable to wait. When do I do tshuva? Maybe I hold it for Yom Kippur. Maybe I don't do it until 2 years from now, 10 years from now. At some point, I'm going to do it. At some point, I'm going to eradicate the bad. But sometimes it's better to just leave. Aziva zachet, leave it. Kabbalah alba, accept in the future not to do it, and walk away. Because sometimes the guilt, the dirty feeling, will destroy you and do worse for you. But in either case, being aware that whatever you've done, Hashem understands, and there's a system to get out of it, to undo it totally and completely. There's a way to eradicate it as if it wasn't there at all. And if Elisha ben Avuya, who became Acher, who arguably was the worst person who ever lived, could have done tshuva, I guarantee you and I can change. But again, you have to understand that tshuva works. You have to understand how it works. And sometimes it's wisest to wait. Sometimes it's wisest to hold off for a while. And I want to focus on one last step. The Tarkanos HaShavim, Sefer written about repairing this issue, makes a very important point on this very Gemara. He explains that a bas kol is something unique. We don't hear bas kols every day. We don't hear heavenly voices. He explains that when we have Nevi'im, a Navi is given a Nevuah. But once the Nevuah stopped, Hashem speaks to man through a bas kol. But a bas kol is something that's unique, very unusual, and only given for particular reasons. So he asks the question, if this Acher turned Latar Bezra, he comes down from paradise, he sees Hashem, comes down, and decides that's it. I'm out of here. So if Hashem recognizes that he's turned to evil ways, and imagine for a minute that Hashem doesn't want him back, why give the bas kol? How'd the bas kol help him? And if you mean to tell me that the normal system of tshuva doesn't, why tell him that? Why does he get a special bas kol that tell him, shuvu vanim, shuvim except for Acher? Why do it? And the Tekana Shavim explains that what Hashem was doing for Acher was a tremendous chesed. He was telling him, you hit bottom. You've bottomed out. You've changed things. The normal system of tshuva won't work. You could do tshuva, but the normal system of tshuva won't work. And the reason why Hashem told him this was to spur him on to do tshuva. Because sometimes it's not until you hit bottom. It's not until you crash that it really hits you. And sometimes it is that you need that hitting absolute depth bottom to actually turn it around. And what Hashem wanted to do for Elisha ben Avuya is wake him up. Let him understand the gravity of what he did. Let him understand how bad it was, so that he could then turn it around. But the reason why Hashem spoke in that bas kol was for the benefit of him, to help him. And this is a tremendous understanding, because if Hashem wanted back even this man, who became the worst human being could ever imagine, surely Hashem wants us back. And this understanding is essential to recognize. There will be many times when you'll hit bottom. Hitting bottom can mean anything from looking at yourself and saying, what have I done to myself, to getting caught doing something when it's clear and obvious. And when you hit bottom, sometimes it's the greatest thing that might have happened to you. And sometimes you could see the Yad Hashem. sometimes a guy gets caught doing something and it's so clear that he was framed. It's obvious that his wife was supposed to find out. It's obvious that people were supposed to know about it. It's clear that he was set up for it. And at that point, you're supposed to get it and you say, I understand. Hashem loves me. Hashem wants me back. Hashem orchestrated these events so I should hit bottom. And so the crash of reality should be right there so I could turn it around. And is it embarrassing? Oh, it sure is. And does it hurt? It sure hurts. But 130 years in Gehenna is worth it to suffer pain. And again, the Rishonim explained, Gehenna isn't burning. There's no body. The Esh, the fire of embarrassment, when you stand in front of others and they see you for what you are, and at that moment you recognize, fool that I was, that embarrassment is so hurtful that it feels like fire, but not your hand burning, not your whole body burning, not even being in a kiln. 60 times the hottest fire you could find is the embarrassment of Gehenna, because at that point we recognize the truth. And if you suffer through situations in this world, it's important to understand that Hashem brings them for your good. Hashem loves you. Hashem wants you to change. Hashem wants you to grow, because for eternity you'll be what you shape yourself into. And the greatest damage of a chait is that it doesn't allow you to grow. How many guys could have been great? How many guys could have been astounding human beings, but they crippled themselves, either because of sin itself or because of the guilt and the associated feelings of dirtiness and, ugh, look at me, I'm a filthy slob. What you have to do is, if you could do tshuva, then you do it. If it's not the right time, either because you're not ready for it or because it might hurt you, you put on your white kittel. In your mind's eye, I'm clean. Will I change today? No. I'll change in 2 years and 10 years. Eventually, this will be gone. But right now, I'm a holy Jew. I'm wearing a white kittel and I'm standing in front of Hashem, knowing that eventually it'll be gone. It'll be clean, and I begin the process. Does that change you instantly? No, but it begins the very, very difficult fight. And if you fight the fight and use the system, daven to Hashem for help, you grow, you change, because that's what Hashem wants from us. Hashem put us on the planet to grow, to be challenged, to fight many, many difficult fights. But at the end of the day, Hashem wants us to grow, wants us to accomplish. Hashem doesn't give us neshonos that we can't stand, but more than that, Hashem is right there with us, waiting. Take one step forward and I'll push from behind. And take one little step and I'll do the rest. Shuv uvanim, shuv uvim applies to every one of us. We're nowhere near acher. And when we understand that we can change, we can grow. Right now, in my mind's eye, I put on that white kittel. I know it's going to be in the future, 10 years from now, maybe 20 years from now, I'll be clean. And I'm borrowing that kittel now, and I'm starting to change. And I feel holy, good, and proper. And I know eventually I'll get rid of this totally. And with that strength and with that energy, a person begins fighting the fight for real. Is the fight easy? It sure isn't. It's a long, difficult battle, but it's worth it. Hashem helps. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu grant us the ability to understand this, perceive this, put this into action, and change for the better.